This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And, of course, you can listen to us streaming at the same time at prairiepublic.org and find the show after it's been broadcast at prairiepublic.org anytime you'd care to. And today we're going to start our show with an interview with two people who have been in combat and in combat zones and have created works of art around that. Miles Lugosi was a combat camera operator in Afghanistan. He joins us by phone from Half Moon Bay near San Francisco. Miles, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Matt Young served in Iraq. He teaches composition, literature, and creative writing at Centralia College. He's coming to us from Olympia, Washington, and he's written a memoir titled Eat the Apple about his experience. Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Well, let's start with you, Miles. You and Matt were pretty young when you enlisted, around 18 or so, or getting on to 19. Why did you enlist, Miles?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think from reading Eat the Apple, I think our reasons were sort of similar. Matt crashed his car and enlisted a few days after that. I had a similar kind of it was sort of an impulsive decision for me as well. I think a lot of kids that join the Marine Corps especially are looking for some kind of way to differentiate themselves or find an identity that they haven't been able to find in school or, you know, family, whatever. And so I kind of fell into that category of like, I need to go experience something that I'm not going to be able to experience in college. And, you know, just kind of challenge myself, I guess. It wasn't really an altruistic, you know, self-sacrificial decision like, you know, like you would think.
Matt, how about you?
So what Miles said is, he put it very nicely that I crashed my car, but I crashed my car while I was drunk when I was 18. I took a year off of high school. My parents couldn't afford to send me to college. So, I had enlisted in a community college and then, you know, I kind of fell into this pattern of partying and drinking and drugs. And, I was working two jobs, both second shift and third shift, and both kind of outside in the Midwest winter, and it was pretty miserable. And because of that, you know, anything that wasn't work in my spare time was kind of drinking and partying. And when I crashed my car, I kind of woke up the next morning. Nobody had gotten hurt. I hadn't gotten hurt. A fire hydrant got knocked over. But when I woke up the next morning, I had this, you know, this shameful, horrible guilt feeling that sounds pretty natural. And I was driving home and I drove past an armed forces recruiting center, that was in a strip mall, and decided to stop in. And the only office that happened to be open that day was the Marine Corps. So, there's kind of my, final reasoning. I think a lot of it, the Marines sounded good to me at the time because I think, you know, I felt like I needed to be punished for what I was doing with my life. I didn't feel like I was in a good place. And you know, I was an angry teen. I wanted to, you know, hurt people. I think, you know, a lot of teen boys, especially white teen boys, tend to feel that way. You know, you're kind of lost in the world, and the Marine Corps kind of gives you direction and kind of gives you a way to funnel that rage towards something.
You were both going to be featured at the UND Writers Conference this year. And, of course, the Writers Conference, like so many things, has been canceled because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But we're glad to have you by phone to talk about what is an engaging story that you each have. And, Miles, I'm going to go back to you because Matt's sort of touched on this, too. When you joined the Marines, were you surrounded by people that were sort of in there for the same reason?
It's a pretty diverse group, obviously. You got good kids, you got bad kids, you got angry kids. Like Matt said, I was pretty angry. You got aggressive kids, you got psychopaths, you got sweethearts. You know, it runs really the whole gauntlet of personalities. But I do think there's a common thing where it's sort of the Marine Corps is a fast track to manhood, you know, like taking a few years to go to college or become an adult in that sense is not as appealing, I think, to especially young boys who are 18 and figuring out who they are and what they want to do. It's sort of that fast track to somewhere else, you know?
Well, you became a combat camera operator in Afghanistan, and the movie that you created from the stuff you brought back, much of it not, I think, apparent to the Marine Corps at the time, became a documentary called Combat Obscura. Matt, you were in Iraq. What was your duty there?
I was an infantryman with 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. Originally, I was a rifleman, which is you're kind of a jack of all trades. The weapons, I ended up in what's called the weapons company, which is consists of a combined anti-armor team, which are mounted heavy guns like 50 cals and tow missiles, and then an 81 millimeter mortar platoon, which rates, I think, 2 to 4 riflemen to act as security. But I really took to being a mortarman. I got really good at it. And so I ended up being a mortarman for a while until we deployed to Iraq, and they made us all kind of combined anti-armor teams, because during that time there was a lot of IED activity, and so the roads needed to be observed and maintained and patrolled. And to do that on foot became, you know, dangerous and kind of impractical. So they put us in armored vehicles, taught us how to fire heavy weapon systems and mount them, and that's kind of what my job became over the course of 3 different deployments.
I'm going to ask you both this question, but I'll go back to Miles first. Miles, was the experience you had in combat in Afghanistan what you expected it to be, or was it so different that it might be hard to explain?
Yeah, it's pretty hard. It, you know, that's what I love about Matt's book so much, is that it really, it shows every aspect of it, you know, the crazy, the beautiful, the really messed up aspects, the way that it affects you, and it makes you kind of wear a mask at times to become a different person. But as far as like what I expected going into it, I mean, our generation, we grow up on movies. Like that's where we get most of our education about war.
And you're a fan of Stanley Kubrick, Full Metal Jacket.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, all the anti-war movies of yesteryear were kind of our recruiting tools, ironically. But it's never like the movies. It is like the movies in some ways, which is kind of weird. But it's also very different, you know.
It ends up being like the movies in a lot of ways that people force it to be like the movies. A lot of us get our soundtrack from old Vietnam movies. Like people are still like blaring Creedence Clearwater Revival out of their Humvees. I think that, a lot of our senior Marines get their affects from how they see, you know, senior military NCOs operating like in movies, like they're yelling at you or hazing or whatever it is, comes directly from a movie like Full Metal Jacket or something like that. And I think that like those are kind of these really strange, surrealistic moments that you don't really think about in the moment, because you're like, oh yeah, this is how it's supposed to be. But then, you know, 5-10 years down the line, when you think back to that memory, you're like, oh my God, you know, this thing is being enacted from a fictional standpoint, although, you know, based on Michael Hare's book Dispatches, I think still is kind of this, you know, it's this weird way the cycle is enacted of kind of indoctrination, but also of you know, these trauma cycles that are continuously kind of just thrown at people, and you're forced to kind of, you know, drop into them.
Or Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. Miles, in your filmmaker statement around the movie that you've created, the documentary Combat Obscura, you say, "I filmed the war as a propaganda tool for the Marine Corps. You couldn't show anyone cursing or smoking cigarettes during a firefight, and casualties were often forbidden from being exposed. But obviously, you came back with some stuff that wasn't propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and that, the film kind of toes that line between propaganda and then just the complete opposite. But then, like Matt was saying, the sort of performative aspects of it as well. Because, like, being a cameraman with the infantry, like Matt was in infantry, it just adds to that sort of we're at war, we need to act a certain part, we need to show, you know, the real side of it. So, like, ironically, a lot of it, a lot of the behavior in Combat Obscura isn't sometimes real, quote unquote, realistic, because they're performing for the camera.
Yes. And they know it.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's a very, it's a surreal experience. And then, like he was saying, when you come back, you're kind of, you have to prove to people, you want people to understand your experience. So you resort back to the films, but it's not like, it's not, you know, it's sometimes it's not as bad as the movies, or it's, you know, I mean, the best way I can describe it is, like, in a film, when people get shot at, it's not the same, because you're not, when you get shot at in real life, it kind of hurts. Like, it hurts inside. And if you're not experiencing that hurt in the movie theater, then you're not really understanding it. And it's one of the reasons I made the film so loud, because, like, when it plays in movie theaters, it, like, really, it really messes with people. You know, people get really affected because it's so loud. And it, you know,
well, it's loud in real life, I take it.
Yeah.
In your growth from innocence to experience, from, you know, coming from wherever you came from to a violent place, a war environment, where thou shalt not kill is, well, except when we hand you the gun and say, kill these people. How about that kind of 180 degree change in direction? How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, the Marines really, I mean, specifically, I think, I mean, my, you know, I can't speak for any other service, but the Marines specifically really, I mean, train you to kind of leave that part of yourself behind. And so it doesn't feel so much like a 180, as it feels, you know, like the idea behind boot camp and indoctrination and having the, like, being surrounded by other Marines and being on a base and being this kind of your day-to-day life, is that you forget to some extent your identity before. And it's not like the Marines erase your identity, because that's kind of an impossibility, but they do, but it does, especially give you this strong sense of place and belonging and kind of like, you know, filial piety and brotherhood and all these kind of things that we think of when we think of the military. And those act as like this replacement for your identity before. Of course, I mean, there's always, I think, you know, this is speaking to my experience. I think oftentimes there, you know, there are people that hang on to who they were before the Marine Corps. But I think that's also what makes leaving the military so difficult for a lot of people, is because you have to then readjust your identity that you've built, whether it be for 8, 16, 20 years of service. You have to then figure out what it's like to be without that thing, or to build something that's as strong as the identity that you built in the military. And the military has become very good at creating identities for people and giving you the identity that they want you to have. So when they ask you to do something like go to a foreign country and detain people, or, you know, put a kid in a cage, or point this gun at somebody and fire, it doesn't feel like you're, you know, kind of interrupting any of your scruples. You're doing what's natural. And so it doesn't feel like a 180. I don't think it feels like you're still facing the right direction when it's happening. I think in the aftermath, or the after years of it, that's when it starts to, when you start to question that thing, or when you're without that identity, that support system, then it starts to feel less than good than it did in the moment.
Matt Young served in Iraq. He enlisted in 2005. He's the author of a memoir titled Eat the Apple. Miles Lugosi served in Afghanistan. He enlisted in 2008, and he's the producer and editor and creator of the film Combat Obscura. Miles, did your military experience change you or your attitude towards service? Because in some of the press kit for the movie, for example, the conflict you were in is referred to as the Forever War.
Of course, yeah, of course it changes you. I don't think it changed. I think being a cameraman it's a little easier to keep part of yourself because being in the infantry is so vastly different. You know, it's like the infantry is, I guess I would describe it as like, you know, being kind of a desk worker most of the time versus constantly being around the same platoon that you're in or line company, going to the field constantly, drinking excessive. I mean, we drank excessively too, but not, I don't think quite as much as the infantry did.
And smoked occasionally.
Yeah. I mean, when you're downrange, it's sort of a free for all because no one's really watching. Like what people don't understand is that it's not the older guys that are really conducting the war. It's the 18, 19, 22-year-olds who are constantly going outside the wire, talking to the locals, killing people, getting shot at, et cetera. So being in the infantry, it's just being surrounded constantly with that culture that me as a cameraman, when I wasn't in Afghanistan or attached to an infantry unit, I was much cushier and not as kill-centric. You know, not quite as fraternity-esque, I suppose.
I think the word you're looking for, Miles, is cult.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt, earlier you spoke of your difficulty talking to family members about your experiences, and perhaps that led up to the process that became this book. How would you describe the book you created, Eat the Apple?
I don't. That's a really good question. I don't know how I would describe it. I think other people might describe it as a therapy session. Although, although it was extremely re-traumatizing, I think, in writing the book, I went into it kind of hoping that I was gonna. I guess maybe by the time I was working on it, I had hoped that maybe I would exercise some demons, but I don't. But I think ultimately it kind of threw me a little bit further into them and or maybe them into me. I'm not sure, but it was difficult. I think it's I would call it if I'm going to put on my academic hat, I would call it a hybrid text. You know, it plays with form and plays with length and plays with content quite a bit. And also and kind of blurs the lines between fiction and nonfiction. Although never does break into true fiction. So, I think it's surreal. I think it tries to be darkly comedic. I don't know if those jokes land often. I think probably they do. I've been really surprised in the reception of the novel or the memoir and the jokes that people do get, even if they weren't in the military. I think that's always kind of surprising to me. I didn't write it with a military or civilian audience in mind. I wrote it kind of asking people to be kind of covered by the thing that I was writing. And kind of experience it fully, which has to do with, you know, I change perspectives often in the book and use we, you know, at first person plural, I use second person, third person. I think a lot of that is to one, kind of like force people to experience, you know, my perspective from this very honest place. It's my attempt to be more honest in writing my experience, but also it's to kind of close the distance between audience and writer. And that works for some people, and for some people it doesn't. But I think complicated is maybe the best word for it.
I would describe it as like being put through, kind of being regurgitated back through like the mechanism, the meat grinder that is the Marine Corps. I mean, like, I've never read something that so honestly captures not just like the war, but the institution of the Marine Corps. So I could relate to it a lot, especially, I mean, one thing that Eat the Apple really captures, I think, is the self-loathing that you feel after doing all these the horrible things that we did as a cult, as a pack of young men, not just in war, but in garrison too, you know? Then coming out of it and hating yourself, but also being torn between this critical thing to your upbringing, like your life, this thing that will never leave you, that you're simultaneously kind of proud of because you made it, you went through it and you made it out. So that duality, I think, is captured really, really well in the book.
Well, Miles, in this day of smartphones that can shoot high-def video, it's kind of intriguing to think of all those veterans who are probably among us who've got very graphic evidence of what they did. You have had a bit of blowback from the Marine Corps, from NCIS for that matter, which isn't just the name of a TV show, about the content of Combat Obscura.
Yeah. I don't know what they were doing exactly. I got a call from some NCIS agent, and I met with him in New York. I just wanted to see like what he was looking at exactly. And you know, they had printouts, they had like screen grabs from the film, because I had sent it to the Pentagon to get basically some kind of stamp of approval that, hey, this is not classified, you can show this to the public, so that I didn't get royally, like, at that point I didn't even have a lawyer, and I didn't want to go to jail or get sued or whatever. And I didn't want to deal with the Marine Corps directly, because I knew that they would just, you know, lose their shit. Yeah, meeting with NCIS, they they had, like, screenshots all from different scenes, like the chicken, them killing a chicken, drug use, stuff like that. So it was a very strange experience. And then meeting with a couple Marine Corps officials as well, just to kind of, you know, let them know, because they weren't really sure what I was trying to do. I think they were more concerned about what I was trying to say with the film. And so then just meeting with them and being like, look, you know, this is my experience. It doesn't represent everyone's experience. I think it represents the vast majority of grunts in Afghanistan, of the grunt experience. But yeah, it was strange, kind of working with them and also trying to keep a distance, you know, because there was still a threat of legal action.
Well, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but that's very intriguing. I suspect that there's been a little bit of reaction from the people you served with, Matt and Miles, as well. But we've simply run out of time, and I really do thank you for spending some time with us today. Again, Matt Young and Miles Lugosi were supposed to be participants in this year's UND Writers Conference, which was canceled because of the pandemic. Matt Young is the author of Eat the Apple. He teaches creative writing and other courses at Centralia College and lives in Olympia, Washington. Miles Lugosi is the creator of the documentary Combat Obscura. He served as a combat camera operator in Afghanistan. And again, both of you, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're all taking steps to protect our health. Well, how about self-care steps? But first, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. A pipeline company is waiting federal approval of a plan to build 62 miles of natural gas pipeline in Williams, McKenzie, Montreal, and Burke counties. The project is known as the Northern Bakken Expansion Project and is proposed by WBI Energy Transmission, a subsidiary of Bismarck-based MDU Resources Group. The 24-inch diameter line would run from WBI's Energy's Tioga Compressor Station to a new interconnect with the Northern Border Pipeline Company in McKenzie County. It would also include a new compressor station.
The North Bakken Expansion Project will provide an additional 350 million cubic feet per day of natural gas takeaway capacity from the gas processing plants in the Bakken in northwest North Dakota.
Laura Leder is manager of the Communications and Public Relations for MDU Resources Group.
Ideally, you know, this project is going to continue to aid in the reduction of natural gas flaring out of the Bakken.
The project's price tag, $300 million. The company has filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and awaits FERC approval. Leder says the plan is to start construction in early 2021 and have it up and running by November 1st of that year. A Bismarck woman who tested positive for coronavirus has gone public, hoping others in her age group will learn from her experience. Alicia Rich works at the Bismarck Airport, where she may have contracted the illness. Rich says she had a fever and tested positive after a visit to her doctor's office. Rich is 21. She's in self-quarantine at her parents' home where she lives. The state health department has been working to track those that she had contact with. While still not fully recovered, Rich says she is feeling better. Governor Burgum says despite concerns about dropping oil prices and a weak ag economy, all as the state deals with the coronavirus epidemic, there is no need at this point to call a special legislative session. Burgum says other states are concerned about potential cash flow problems, but he says North Dakota is in a better position than many states.
We are very fortunate that the strong balance sheets that we have in North Dakota, even with our collapse in energy and agriculture, because the legislature worked together with our office and wisely saved the maximum amount possible, $720 million for the Budget Stabilization Fund. That represents 15% of our general fund. So we've got 15% of our general fund covered if we have that kind of a downturn.
Burgum also says through February, the state was also running ahead of projection revenue collections. He says he could also access the Budget Stabilization Fund if there needed to be allotments or budget cuts before the 2021 legislature. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the U.S. We'll be answering your questions live every weekday on The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
The National Conversation. Listen weeknights at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now from the social distance approved comfort of her own home is self-care coach Randy Kay. Randy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So in the time of a pandemic, I'm all prepared. I'm going to be glued to the news and to Facebook, and I'm going to stress eat and not go outside or get any exercise. I'm totally good, right?
Totally. It's exactly what you should be doing.
Okay, we'll deconstruct that one at a time here. How about being glued to the news?
Yes. So let me just preface by saying that there is no right or wrong way to be dealing with this situation. There's so much unknown going on. There are new scenarios and new stressors and new information coming out every moment, pretty much. To judge yourself on how you're dealing with it is going to add to your stress. So if you have been glued to your screen, if you have been stress eating, like all of these things, like we kind of all did that in our own ways, and that's totally okay because this is such a weird situation. But after listening to this conversation, or as we start to get a better grasp on what this is going to look like, then we can start to be more intentional about how we're going to move forward and the best practices for us as we start to really move through this and move past like the initial shock of it all. For myself, I've allowed this past week to just be pretty messy, to allow myself not to have it all together and not to know what to do, which is hard as someone in the health and wellness field where people are looking to me for guidance. But I have to do it too. Like, I'm there with everybody also. Having those moments of tuning in, feeling the feels, having your moments that are messy, but then also when you feel like you're in a little bit of calmer state, being like, okay, what's the best way for me to move forward? How has being glued to the news served me? And chances are it's not serving you very well. And so then we get to create some boundaries around that. If we're stress eating every day, how is that really going to help you cope? Not very well. So how can we start to curb that now and balance it out? So it's a matter of just like being able to zoom out, see how you've been behaving and been responding, and then making decisions on how to move forward from here without too much judgment or guilt or all this other stuff we tend to throw in the mix of things.
Right. Well, no offense, but a lot of what you said is not super easy and doesn't really come naturally to a lot of people. So what are some good ways, though, to help us recognize when a behavior, okay, yeah, you got to shake it off right away. You want to stress eat those whole chips. And that's, like you said, that can be good for just that first, like, sort of shock response. But how do you really recognize when it has gone past that?
Yeah, that is a tricky question. It's different for everybody, but your body is going to tell you when you need to invite in some other behaviors. Like, you are the best gauge of what you're needing. And if you're getting to a point where what you're doing is perpetuating the anxiety and the stress, then it's probably time to bring in some other things. Again, this is a tough situation to navigate. And self-care was challenging anyway to implement into our lives. And so asking us to do that now, it could either be easier because you are at home and you are finding that you have more time to check in with yourself and keep yourself entertained. Or you might find you have less time because now all of your kids are at home and it's really hard to function. So it's just kind of when you can, taking a moment to just take a deep breath. Honestly, taking a deep intentional breath is one of the most effective things you can do to see how you're doing. If you do that and you just say, how are you? Like, you can get a lot of information. Generally, we dismiss a lot of these simple practices thinking like, oh, well, what's a deep breath going to do? Or what's a journaling going to do? What's, you know, anything going to really do? But it's a way to break the stress response that's happening in your body and deregulate that on a very physiological level. And so if you can, it's like hitting the refresh button. So if you can take a deep breath and see how you're holding your body, notice the tension that you're holding, notice the quality of your mind and your thoughts, that's going to give you a lot of really valuable information, and you can make a call from there.
What are your favorite breath practices? You know, one deep breath can be helpful, but there are sort of these different ways that you can manipulate the breath, and they have different impacts.
Yeah, my favorite are, they're very simple, but one is equal part breath. And so you're inhaling the same amount of counts as you're exhaling. So you would inhale for the count of three, take a little bit of a pause, and then exhale for the count of three. And that counting and that rhythm can be very therapeutic, and it gives your brain something to do, so it can allow the rest of the body to calm down. The other one is it's a three-part breath where you inhale in three different kind of quadrants of your torso. So you inhale with the low belly, and when that's full, you inhale through the lungs, like under the rib cage. And when that's full, you inhale through the chest, and then you exhale all of that out. And that's a really great way to just create some space and allow those muscles to engage, and it really calms a lot of where we're holding our tension. It can invite that to calm down.
Well, I've noticed, you know, when doctors are going to give you a shot and it's going to hurt, they tell you to sing the ABCs, or, you know, especially if you've got a kid in there. just something to distract you.
We use those things with children, but there's a lot of wisdom to that method. It allows the rest of the body to calm down when your brain is occupied with something familiar and repetitive.
What's happening in our bodies when we breathe into the belly versus when we breathe into the chest?
A few things. One is that, anatomically speaking, we are meant to be breathing with our lower abdominal muscles. So with the diaphragm, they're meant to house the breath by their shape and their power. They can handle that constant repetitive activity throughout the day. And then if you think about your chest and neck muscles, they're small and are doing a lot of other things to stabilize and move the neck and the shoulders. And so they don't have the same capacity. They weren't meant to be engaged so much throughout the day. Mm. And so when we use those muscles, it maxes them out and can create more tension. And so that's just a really practical reason why. The other is that breathing with the diaphragm and the low belly muscles, it signals to the brain, to the parasympathetic nervous system, or the rest and relax nervous system, that it can calm down. And so it signals to the brain that it can let go of tension and start a more relaxing response within the body. When we keep the breath high in the neck and shoulders, it's just perpetuating more tension and more stress, really.
Okay, so slowing down that breathing, and often it's very helpful to have a nice straight spine if you're sitting and leaning on the back of the wall. And, you know, I have heard time and again that this is why this is a major hang-up for people who don't want to have a meditation practice. For starters, they think they have to be good at it to begin with, and it's not mm-hmm. something that you can learn. And that also that you have to have that sort of classic eyes closed, straight spine, sitting for hours at a time. And I'll just, you know, make a confession for myself. I started out like a good little yogi the other day, doing exactly that, legs crossed, eyes closed, straight spine. And I was breathing and listening to rhythmic, repetitive music. And then I couldn't take it anymore. And I just got up and did some terrible dancing, like that the cutscene that always comes together from the Breakfast Club. And thankfully, I was alone. You mentioned this at the beginning, stop judging yourself. And you can be a mess and you can be silly, and finding the medicine in that.
Yes. So there's a time and a place for all practices. There is wisdom to the traditional, what you think of as meditation. That is a practice, that is a discipline, and it can be a really beautiful thing over time. But there's also a time for just tuning into what you're needing and letting it be messy and whatever your body is calling for. And so for many people, sitting like that is not possible. Their hips aren't open, their backs don't have that strength. It's not a comfortable position. So I rarely meditate that way, to be honest. I always do it on my back, because then I can just let my body weight like melt into the floor and I don't have to focus on my posture very much. And so I recommend you can meditate like in your bed, like anywhere you can just feel comfortable. And the more discomfort you have in your body, the harder it's going to be for you to really surrender and go deeper within. And so wherever your starting point is wherever your starting point is. And there's no right or wrong. It's just the truth. And so you get to work from that space, and that's where you'll actually improve and receive the therapeutic benefits instead of trying to be somewhere else on your path with that. And then meditation, it can look so many different ways. The key is to make it mindful. So an intentional practice where you're tuning in, when you can add an element of repetition that is good. Honestly, I just use my breath as the mindful repetition, and then I can turn anything I'm doing into more of a meditative, intentional practice. I've been using cooking as an example. I'm not like a natural, I love cooking kind of person, but I know that I need to be nourishing my body the best way that I can. And so I would turn my making meals and cleaning up after myself into my self-care practice for the day. So instead of formally sitting down to meditate, I would turn my daily activity into my self-care and my meditation and as a calming practice. And so this is how we can just make tweaks in our day-to-day tasks and turn them into something that can serve us on a deeper level. And so if you are stuck at home and you have a lot of family members that you're serving or whomever you share your space with, can you tweak something you're doing and turn it into this like personal little retreat or a way to just slow down your breath and check in while you're still doing the things that you need to do? And when you can do that, then you have more of a foundation to turn it into a formal practice later. A lot of times we think it needs to be the opposite, where we have to go all out and have this long, perfect meditation or yoga practice before we can apply it to our everyday lives. But sometimes it actually helps to just start with what you can do and let it grow into whatever it ends up turning into.
Kind of like how we learn anything.
Yeah.
We're visiting with self-care coach Randy Kay, and she has a wealth of information and resources available on her website, Naturally Randy Kay, where you can subscribe also to her podcast. And Randy, you are, of course, a small business owner, and in addition to your self-care coaching, you also are teaching yoga, and you provide a couple of different kinds of massage. Obviously, we're not supposed to go around touching people right now. How is COVID-19 impacting small businesses like yours?
Oh, it's tough. When I mentioned that this week has been messy for me, it's when I've had to make the call on what I'm going to do with my brick and mortar business and seeing clients and what the right thing to do is. And as you can assume, the right thing to do is to not be doing that right now. So I've had to make the decision to pause my practice and try to figure out how to pay the rent of a big space like that with nothing or try to push my online offerings more, but knowing that right now is not the right time. It's very confusing. And so I know with my kind of business, it's not as big of a scale as a restaurant or a retail business, and there aren't options like come in and pick it up or buy these products online. In my community, it's been this kind of like, I don't know, what are you doing? Like, like hopefully you have some savings. I don't know. It's been weird, and it's been unknown, and it's been like, do we stop seeing clients? How do we manage that? Like what? And especially in our area where we still have yet to see how it's going to show up in our community. We're just beginning to know the truth of what's going on. It's been tough, but it's been also cool to just start to get creative. Local business hired me to lead a meditation virtually for their employees. So I got to do that this week. And I'm like, wow, I never even thought of that. There are other ways to serve that I think a lot of us are starting to tune into in ways that we didn't think.
So what are those tools that you're using? Are you doing this via FaceTime, Skype?
I use Zoom. That's what I use to record interviews with my podcast. So it's already a platform I'm familiar with. And there's a free version of that when it's just two people that are using it. If it's more of a group setting, then I think you have to upgrade. Although I wonder if they're offering deals right now because everyone's kind of switching over to that. You can use FaceTime. You can use Google Hangouts, I think is still a thing. Skype, there's a lot of softwares that are already existing and really easy to use. You probably already have the software in your phone that people can start to tune into. And if you're not very tech savvy, they're very easy to use. So that's been a lot of people in my industry, you know, with the massage part, it's kind of like, what can you do with that?
Yeah. I don't think virtual massage exists yet.
No, although there, I don't know. It is like you can visualize getting a massage, and visualization is really powerful.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something you want to try on your own, but, you know, self-massage is also really helpful. I mean, I do teach a lot of ways to manage pain and self-care without having to get a massage. And so that's something that I'm going to be putting forward in the future. I do have some online courses that I host through teachery.co. There's a lot of online platforms for education that people can use that are easy, pretty user-friendly. So I use Teachery. Other ones are teachable.com. That's another way, is to take the knowledge that I, for example, with me, that I would share with my clients in person, putting it in an online platform so people can start to take care of themselves better. And so I have those online courses that I never talk about, but I guess now I'll be talking about them more. It's hard as a business owner. I love promoting how I can help my other small business friends. I have a hard time doing that for myself. Mm-hmm. And so just know that the hairstylist, the massage therapist, the service industry, independent service industry people are not used to promoting themselves. They're not used to being like, I'm having a tough time, will you help me? Usually our client base is referrals and regular people coming in. So it's a different kind of marketing than even a spa or these retail stores.
Sure.
And so it's hard for us to know how to ask for help right now. So if you have people that you go to regularly, if you're able to, and you want to be supporting small businesses right now, ask them if you can buy a gift card, pre-book appointments, because a lot of people in my industry are really struggling to know how to ask for help and what to do, and even how to, they've never had to market themselves in that way before. Don't forget about them.
Randy Kay is a self-care coach, and when COVID clears up, she may be going back to being a massage therapist, Thai body worker as well. You can find out more at her website, naturallyrandyk.com, and that's Randy with an I. Randy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll have more Main Street in a moment.
When the world is uncertain, who can you trust?
Both Hong Kong and Singapore continue to find a few new cases each week, but they've avoided the explosive outbreaks that have occurred elsewhere.
When it's important to hear from somebody local who has the access.
Officials with the North Dakota Department of Health say we are in a strong position when it comes to detecting and preventing the spread of the coronavirus in nursing homes and other care centers.
We have a substantial medical cache.
There's no time like now to listen to your trusted source for fact-based independent journalism.
Dr. Bruce Aylward of the World Health Organization says it's important that everyone learn to recognize the symptoms of COVID-19.
It's a high fever in 90% of cases, a dry cough in 70% of them. You also have to know what it is not. It's not the sniffles. It's not a runny nose. That can be a symptom, but that's rare.
Listener-supported Prairie Public is North Dakota's home for NPR News and essential regional coverage.
So what will the drones be looking for?
Ice jamming is a big concern. It raises havoc on our bridges.
Listen like it matters on your radio, online, or on your smart speaker. We are Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for March 23rd. Richard Beck was a teacher, scholar, writer, poet, and honorary North Dakotan. Beck was born on June 9, 1897 in Iceland. Unfortunately, his father passed away in 1907 when Richard was only 10, leaving his mother to raise him. He attended school in Reykjavik and graduated high school in 1920. He married that same year on October 10th to Olaf Daniel's daughter. Their life together proved tragically short when around this date in 1921, his bride died. In the fall of that year, Richard and his mother emigrated to Winnipeg. Richard left for Ithaca, New York in 1922 to attend Cornell University, where he studied English and Scandinavian literature. He received his M.A. in 1924 and Ph.D. in 1926. He married Bertha Una Crispjorg in 1925, and they had two children, Margaret Helen and Richard Jr. In 1929, the family moved to Grand Forks, where Beck joined the staff at the University of North Dakota. He headed the Department of Modern and Classical Languages. During his time at UND, he published 15 books and over 500 articles. Eventually, both UND and the University of Iceland would give him honorary doctorates. He also served as honorary consul of Iceland for North Dakota. Sadly, both his mother and wife passed away in 1958. He remarried 3 years later to Margaret Branson, whom he spent the rest of his days with. He retired in 1967 after 38 years at UND. That same year, the pair moved to Victoria, British Columbia. On December 16, 1971, Richard and Margaret held a ceremony at their home where they presented an initial volume from their vast collection of Icelandic and Scandinavian books to the University of Victoria. That wealth of knowledge was slowly transferred over the years, and in their wills, they also left money to fund public lectures on Icelandic literature and culture. Richard Beck died July 23, 1980, and Margaret followed him 5 years later. And on February 14, 1988, the first Richard and Margaret Beck lecture on Icelandic literature took place. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
As the Affordable Care Act turns 10, available health care is more relevant for patients than ever.
I felt more in charge of my cancer than I ever felt about the insurance situation.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How did the Affordable Care Act change healthcare 10 years ago, and how's the coronavirus changing healthcare today? That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered comes up next here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Tuesday on Main Street, Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, is a new book inspired by a symposium of the same name that was held in Dickinson in 2017. On our show tomorrow, we'll talk about the book with Clay Jenkinson, one of the editors. We'll also discuss a new film about Roosevelt and popular culture. And Prairie Public music host Scott Prebus will talk with a member of the Heartland Marimba Quartet in Waterloo, Iowa. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.